You are listening to a summary of John Maynard Keynes, a book by Robert Skidelsky.
This tome, including more than 100 pages of notes and indices, is an abridgment of author Robert Skidelsky's original three-volume biography of John Maynard Keynes. It is in all respects an extraordinary work. The author offers a portrait of Keynes not only as an economist but also as a philosopher and a statesman. He does not segregate these three dimensions, but rather shows how they interpenetrate and inform each other. He sets Keynes in the context of his time and circumstances. Skidelsky is unsparing in his treatment of the inconsistencies and contradictions in Keynes' life and character, but he is fair and balanced. He avoids sensationalism even in the treatment of the sensational. Get Abstract finds that this book merits multiple readings and should intrigue not only economists, but also anyone interested in the ideas and events of the 20th century.
Early years. John Maynard Keynes was born on June 5, 1883. His father was John Neville Keynes, son of John Keynes, a self-made man who had turned a brushmaking enterprise into a prosperous manufacturing business and then made a fortune in flowers. Neville was an only son by his father's second wife, the first having succumbed to cholera. He entered Cambridge in 1872 on a mathematical scholarship, though he eventually moved to moral sciences. In 1875, he was first in his class. Neville studied economics and later wrote two books on the subject. He lectured at several colleges, including the women's residence halls at Cambridge, which had only recently begun admitting women. While lecturing, Neville met Florence Ada Brown, daughter of a scholarly nonconformist clergyman. They married in 1882. John Maynard was their first child. His sister Margaret was born in 1885, his brother Geoffrey in 1887. The parents favored John, perhaps inordinately. This disparity took a toll on Geoffrey, who achieved great success as a surgeon, but nonetheless felt pained by this well into adulthood. While still a child, John Maynard participated in discussions with his father's learned friends and showed early talent for logic and mathematics. Indeed, he excelled in math, which won him a place at Eton. He took numerous academic prizes there and also participated in sports, at which he neither excelled nor performed dismally. In 1902, he took the Cambridge Higher Certificate examination and, although he had not prepared for it, he came out on top. He entered Cambridge and became a member of the Cambridge Union, a debating society. He spoke frequently on politics, even as a freshman. His forensic abilities were impressive. During his first year, he was invited to join the Cambridge Conversazione Society, also known as the Apostles. This most elite of Cambridge's secret societies met every Saturday evening to consider a paper in a friendly, almost familial intellectual exchange. Members were extremely clever, unworldly, introverted, arrogant, almost incapable of small talk, temperamental and not charming. Among them, Keynes' closest friend was Lytton Strachey, who exercised a formative influence on him. Higher sodomy, and after. Keynes and Strachey saw their homosexuality as the foundation of a code of ethics they called higher sodomy. They believed women to be physically and mentally inferior, and viewed their male compatriots as sexually and ethically preferable. When they helped a young man named Arthur Lee Hobhouse get elected to the Apostles, some members, including Bertrand Russell, saw this election as marking a change in the criteria for membership, favoring sex appeal over intellectual distinction. Hobhouse caused a split between Strachey and Keynes, because, although Strachey loved him, The young man preferred Keynes, who saw Hobhouse as his first great love, part of the Bloomsbury Circle's aesthetic and intellectual avant-garde. Keynes had a number of love affairs and some casual liaisons with other men, most importantly with painter Duncan Grant. However, in 1918 he met ballerina Lydia Lopakova. They had an affair that deepened, and in 1923 he introduced her to his parents as his betrothed. Their marriage lasted until Easter Sunday, April 21, 1946, when Keynes died with Lydia at his bedside. Economics, diplomacy, and philosophy. Keynes became a lecturer in economics at Cambridge in 1911 and took a deep interest in the financial affairs of the college. He lectured at the London School of Economics and at Cambridge on the approach to currency management in India. In 1912, he contracted to write a book on Indian monetary affairs, Indian Currency and Finance, published in 1913. Praised a currency management regime that took one step away from the gold standard and set up what Keynes called a gold exchange standard, using gold for currency exchanges with other countries, but not for domestic currency. He predicted that such a system would provide the ideal currency of the future. In 1914, shortly before England declared war on Germany, the Treasury sought Keynes' help resolving a financial crisis. Foreigners could not pay what they owed to London firms, and their defaults would threaten the Bank of England's ability to honor the gold standard. Keynes recommended against the bank chairman's request to suspend gold payments, at least to creditors abroad, because of the deleterious effect it would have on London's future credibility as a monetary center. However, Keynes accepted that it might be prudent to restrict internal gold payments. That recommendation prevailed and helped resolve the banking crisis. Keynes criticized the government's extravagant, tax-funded rescue of London firms. He had recommended that the institutions be required to hold those debts for the duration of what most expected to be a rather short war. Notably, this advice was contrary to his personal financial interest, since he and his father had investments whose value would have suffered if the government had not paid the debts. In 1915, Keynes was installed as a Treasury official. Later that year, he participated in the first conference to organize war credits among the Allies. Russia and France lacked the export capacity and the gold to import materials they needed. The conference set in motion a complicated system in which Britain and France would participate in a credit to Russia. Then Russia and France would send gold to the Bank of England, and Britain would issue credit to France. British financial leadership led to England's control of Allied purchasing, treating these various transfers as loans rather than grants led to problems after the war. Moreover, Britain's position as the linchpin of finance for the entire alliance added pressure on the exchange rate of sterling. The British government had financed the war, which was, again, supposed to be short, with debt, which Keynes had opposed. He advocated financing it via taxation instead of government debt, since that would fuel inflation, harming the balance of payments and the sterling-dollar exchange rate. Whatever the merits of his arguments, Keynes made a very unfavorable impression on Lloyd George, who wrote in his memoirs, "He dashed at conclusions with acrobatic ease. It made things no better that he rushed into opposite conclusions with the same agility." Incidentally, in 1916, Keynes requested exemption from military duty on the grounds of conscientious objection. Given that his treasury duty already exempted him, why did he take this step? It may have been a matter of solidarity with his friends in the Bloomsbury Circle, who mostly opposed the war. They criticized Keynes for his attempt to reconcile his avowed sympathy for conscientious objectors with the job of demonstrating how to kill Germans as cheaply as possible. It is plausible that he considered resigning his post at the Treasury. However, he soon was engaged in trying to extricate Britain from another fiscal crisis. In November 1916, the U.S. Federal Reserve Board directed member banks to restrict credit abroad, hoping to pressure the Allies to shorten the war. Britain hemorrhaged gold. In December, President Woodrow Wilson urged a statement of peace terms, and in January he again called for peace without victory. The Germans apparently did not know just how desperate things were for Britain. In what must have been one of the most stupendous misjudgments of the war, Germany sent U-boats against U.S. ships to accomplish what the fiscal crisis had already nearly achieved, cutting off supplies to U.S. allies. America soon declared war on Germany. Once America joined, the problem was not the availability of money, but the terms on which it could be had. The U.S. aimed to dominate the peace settlement and post-war financial and trade arrangements. Britain wanted the best deal it could get. In 1917, another financial crisis occurred in the face of Britain's growing demand for wheat. Just as U.S. funds were leaving London for investment in the Liberty Loan, Keynes went to Washington to help diplomats resolve the crisis. He was less than diplomatic, managing to alienate the British ambassador and the Americans. One relatively kind report said he was rude, dogmatic, and disobliging. The economic consequences of the peace, perhaps Keynes' most brilliant economic writing, concerned the peace talks at Versailles. He described the shared economic problems that had caused or contributed to the war, and noted that an appropriate settlement would have addressed the financial woes still confronting the victors and the defeated. He predicted that peace would be short-lived because politics so dominated economics at Versailles. This is no dull economic treatise. His character sketches of George Clemenceau, Lloyd George, and Wilson are sharp and memorable. Keynes underscored the incompatibility of the simultaneous reduction in Germany's territory and the increase in its liabilities for reparations. Only by boosting exports and cutting imports could Germany eventually generate a surplus from which it might pay, but the liability imposed was unrealistic in terms of what Germany might conceivably afford. The 1920s. During the 1920s, Keynes worked as a financial consultant, corporate director, and journalist. He made money and for a time collected fine art. In 1921, he published his treatise on probability, discussing the meaning of rational conduct under conditions of uncertain knowledge. Keynes saw that a rational actor, even a rational economic actor, must consider not only the optimal way to achieve an end, but the optimal end, ethically optimal. That is, this work implies that seeking a smaller but more probable objective is more rational than pursuing a larger, less probable one. Probability theory and Keynesian economic thinking were related. Keynes thought economists should be aware that economic behavior is uncertain, and that economic conclusions can only be probable at best. No guarantees. He said highly formal presentations of economic ideas are misleading because they give the appearance of certainty where there is none. Thus, rhetoric and intuition must be part of economic argument. In his 1923 book A Tract on Monetary Reform, Keynes summarized his thoughts about the theory, practice, and objects of monetary policy. He said that to achieve stable prices, monetary policy should stabilize monetary demand, not monetary supply. Writing with irony, Keynes attacked the gold standard. He noted that the velocity of circulation, the speed of spending, could cause prices to rise or fall, no matter how much money is in circulation. During the 1800s, special conditions, such as the discovery of new gold reserves, had allowed the supply of gold to expand as needed for commerce. During that era, major nations' gold holdings roughly reflected their competitiveness. However, by the early 20s, the U.S. held most of the gold, so an English return to the gold standard would have meant giving U.S. financial authorities power over British price levels and credit cycles. Most experts saw the gold standard as necessary to guard against inflation, boost industry, and restore sterling to global currency leadership. Keynes said the gold standard caused volatile prices. He warned that resuming it at pre-war rates would require severe credit restrictions and politically impossible devaluation and wage cuts. When Winston Churchill put the country back on the gold standard in 1925, Keynes published a pamphlet called The Economic Consequences of Mr. Churchill. Most economists suggest Keynes was right. Churchill's decision caused overvaluation of sterling, creating economic hardship for Britain. In 1924, Keynes began the Treatise on Money. He noted that because banks created money, only the Bank of England could equalize savings and investments in the U.K. However, the gold standard made it impossible for the bank to adjust interest rates to match savings. Britain suffered massive unemployment. Keynes showed how depression resulted when expected profits were less than the market rate of interest. He seemed prophetic after the 1929 Wall Street crash. In the 30s, despite falling nominal interest rates, real interest rates rose. In 1932, Britain again left the gold standard. Keynes' magnum opus, The General Theory of Employment, Interest in Money, began to evolve in a series of lectures he gave in 1932. By 1934, he was lecturing from the book's proofs. In it, he drew the economy as an aggregate, with employment or unemployment as a consequence of the community's spending and investment decisions. He saw economic decisions as a drama of hope and fear in which the decision not to spend was a hedge against the uncertainty of tomorrow. Keynes' subsequent influence on economic policy during the 30s and 40s is almost impossible to exaggerate. He was, of course, pivotal in the design of the post-war financial architecture laid out at Bretton Woods. The eventual collapse of that architecture in the 1970s may even have been predictable from principles outlined in some of Keynes' very early writings on the gold standard.